Well, good evening, everyone. This is John Anthony, and welcome to this edition of Ending HUD's Tyranny. I want to thank you so much for logging on tonight and kind of stepping away from the election for a few minutes to look at another serious event that's taking place in our lives and something we really need to look closely at. We're very fortunate again tonight. We got all of our guests from 2 weeks ago together. We got Mike Hoskinson here from Huntington Beach, California. Smith Young is here from Colorado, and our friend Dr. Al Freck from New Jersey. So they're going to be helping us go through the rest of that strategic guide that we did not go through the first time. Now, there's a couple of points that I want to touch on. But before I get into that, let me give you just a little bit of guidance here so you know what to look for and where to find information as we're having this discussion. On our website, if you have not already seen it, and the website is sustainablefreedomlab.org, you'll be able to go on there, and on the right side of the page, you'll see a little red toolbox. And if you click on that red toolbox, it'll take you to the page that we're going to be working on today. So you go to sustainablefreedomlab.org, on the right side of the page, click on the red toolbox, and then that will take you to Ending HUD's Tyranny page. And at the very top of that page, or right the third line down, fourth line down, it says Strategic Guide Download Here. So you're going to want to click that guide and download it, because that's your guide. That's what you'll want to keep, that you'll be using. That's kind of your roadmap to help you through the challenges of addressing AFFH. And what you see on the screen are nothing more than links to videos, documents, resources. That's like your little warehouse. Loaded with information that we keep putting more and more in there, and then we kind of break it down so you see where it is and it's easy to find. So those are the two pieces you'll be working with, the strategic guide that you download, and then online you'll see links there that we keep adding more information to help you stay in the fight. What you're going to hear about tonight is how to fight HUD's tyranny. But you're also going to hear later on in the program, there's another initiative that President Obama has started, and I promised I would talk a little bit about that. We've got some documentation on it. I've already been able to upload that, so you'll have access to it when the program is over. But there's some big things that the administration has planned for our small communities, and we need to be very aware of these so we can keep an eye out and do something about it. The good news is that the model that you're learning right now to fight back against AFFH and hold on to your property rights, it's the same model you use with all of it. So you don't really need to learn a whole lot of new different stuff. We just need to get this down and learn how to use it really well. So while you're doing that, while you're going to sustainablefreedomlab.org, click on the red toolbox on the right, and when you get to the page that pops up, click download here, and then download that 5-page document. That's our strategic guide. So while you're doing that, let me talk just a little bit for about a minute here about property rights and why what we're doing is so vitally important, especially today. You know, when our founders created those wonderful documents that govern our country, they took a lot of time out to say that property rights and other specific rights didn't come from the crown or the king or from a future president. They came from nature, or they came from God. And the reasoning was, nature and God don't change the deal on you later on. But kings and queens and presidents, they can change it any time they want. If you look at the Obamacare Act, the Affordable Care Act, well, everybody all of a sudden had the right to have health insurance. Well, wasn't that wonderful? We had that right before, but the deal has now changed. If you go to your doctor, he has to fill out certain forms. If he doesn't fill those forms out, then he's not going to get paid by the government. So that deal has changed. The information you asked has changed. And even the coverage you're going to get down the road will be changing, all based on what that person who now gave you that right has decided you're entitled to. So this is why why property has become so vitally valuable to us. We cannot give up ownership of any piece of it. Justice Saunders out in the Washington Supreme Court said a few years back that the value of property lies in its use, and that's a piece we can't forget. If the use of your property is denied, he said, the value of your property is annihilated, and your ownership is a barren right. I mean, those are pretty definitive terms. If I take away any piece of your ability to use the property that goes, that is yours. For instance, your mineral rights. For instance, if you place a conservation easement on that property. If there's zoning rights to limit what you can and can't do with that property, then in effect, I've annihilated the value of that ownership. So we need to move very cautiously when we make changes to our local zoning and land use laws. The federal government now has gotten involved in that process, and that's why we're here this evening talking about this affirmatively furthering fair housing. You see, the Constitution and the Declaration did not give the federal government the power to control our land use, but they did give them certain powers, and of course all the rest went to the states and to us, people, so we had the bulk of the power. But in those certain powers, if the government redefines what they can do, for instance, if they redefine what civil rights means or desegregation means or what equal justice means or fair housing, then what they can do is tell your community, well, if you don't have fair housing, then you're in violation of the civil rights law and we're going to sue you, so you have to change your laws. And that's exactly what's happening under affirmatively furthering fair housing. The government has changed the deal, decided what they can and can't do, and now they're controlling our local property. So what we're going to be doing tonight, we started last week, two weeks ago, with this strategic guide. And in there we talked about preparation, how we needed to prepare. We talked about our presentation. We talked about professionalism and persistence. Those were the four key areas that we work at in our strategic guide: preparation, presentation, professionalism, and persistence. So we covered the preparation part, where you prepare, where you get ready, you develop your people that are going to work with you. Mike and Smith and Al gave us great advice on how we can go about building groups and how we can go about meeting other people, building teams, developing political champions, and so forth. What we're going to talk about this week is primarily the presentation. When we get into that presentation, you know, how do we do this? Assume you've never presented anything before. All of a sudden, you're kind of, you know, shaking in your boots, and you've asked to speak before the town council, and you're going to present your case about this thing called affirmatively furthering fair housing. So how do you get into that? Now, if you go in your strategic guides on page 3, you'll notice the word presentation is kind of highlighted in green there, has a green box behind it. And we're going to get down this fairly quickly, but we do want to get some meat on the bones here. So we're going to start off with this idea of stating your case. If you're going to meet with people and you're going to say what it is you're talking about, we already talked about kind of having an elevator speech. We went over that a little bit in our last session. Well, now you have an opportunity to meet with the town council. What are you going to do? And I've asked Al Freck if he might talk about that for a couple of minutes, because Al, you've done this, you're experienced with it, and maybe you can share some of our experiences in stating your case in front of a group of town council members, how you did that and how it worked out.
Sure. One thing I try not to do is go before a town council, let's say, cold, in terms of not having any of them know ahead of time what I'm going to talk about. I want them to know what it is ahead of time. And I want to give them some information so they can start to generate in their own mind some questions, and maybe even some questions that would challenge my presentation. So I guess there are two things. One, when we talk about a presentation, you can do it individually, or you can do it at an official meeting. At a town council meeting, let's say. Some town council meetings, nobody speaks. You don't have a dialogue back and forth. In some places, you can have a back and forth with your council. So you should be prepared for that. One of the things I try to do, and I looked at State Your Case there, and you talk about the meetings, both official and individual. I didn't say individual, but I'm saying it's individual, because most of the time, I at least, either myself to my other team members, knew somebody on the different individual councils that we appeared in front of, and they kind of warmed up to the content of what we were going to talk about. So at that point, there are a couple things to do, and I'm going to go over them here, because you said in your in your presentation, don't make mistakes, i.e. don't exaggerate. You said be known for your accuracy. Well, that gets into the research prep. But the one thing I always tried to do in my presentations before the council is to emphasize to them that this is not just my opinion about things. These, and I would read to them the quotations and quotes from the various HUD documents so that they always knew this isn't, wasn't just me spouting off and my own theories about things. And so then what I would do is read that. I'd tell them what my point was going to be. I'd substantiate it with information from the documents. I would then summarize in lay language, in case there was any bureaucratic mumbo-jumbo in what I read, I'd summarize it and put it into regular lay language. Let me stop there and see if there are any questions on that. Otherwise, I'll just move right on.
So you would meet individually with these persons first, is that it?
Well, here's what I would do, because it would be hard to get to meet with some of the people. They have full-time jobs. They're part-time officials, most of them. I would send them emails. I would meet them. I might see them at a council meeting. I might introduce myself. We always had somebody who knew somebody on the council. If it was my hometown, I did. If it was another town, other people did. They knew somebody. They had dripped on them, you know, this kind of constant dripping. And I will say, we always sent them the AFFH in 5 minutes. Always gave them that. They could look at it.
You know, one thing that I've one thing that I've done when I start my presentation in front of a group, and I like that. I love the way that you're approaching it. You kind of get the people, you build your champions in the background, find out who's for and against you. You kind of test the political water so you know what you're walking into. But then when I get in front of that group, I think we did one with about 13 or 14 different members up there. I start out, because I don't really know who's a Democrat necessarily or who's a Republican and acts like a liberal or whatever. I don't know that always. So what I'll do is start out by saying this really isn't about politics. And I'll say I don't know which people here lean to the left or which lean to the right, and I'm really not concerned about that. We may not agree on all things, and that's fine. But what I am here is about one thing, and that's saying that each person in here retains all of their power, not half of it, not 90% of it, but all of it. Even if we disagree, it's important to me that you have all of your power to do so. And right now that's at risk. And then I'll go into whatever it is I'm talking about. And what I tell these people in conglomerately here that, you know what, your power is at risk. You know, I see people. I see people squirm. I see them look up. I see them lean forward a little bit because, you know, what do you mean my power is at risk? And then I'll go into either the 5-minute AFFH video or whatever it might mean. Does anybody else want to? I know, Smith, you've done a lot with this. Michael, you're on both sides of the fence there. So do you guys have something else you want to share with this?
Yeah, I've got a question for Al. And one thing I ran into recently is I went down to El Paso County here in Colorado and addressed the county commissioners. And what I found out is, you know, they knew me and I'd exchanged email or sent them email. And I'd worked with the staff to some extent, but it was like they were prepared for me. It's like, so when they were voting, I went before them. And I guess my question for Al is, what are your thoughts about when you go into where you're not a resident, because they looked at me like a foreigner. And I'm really not finished with them yet, but, you know, they essentially looked at their attorney and said to their attorney, well, what's the problem here? And their attorney essentially says low risk. And, you know, I almost felt like I was a foreigner. And I'm wondering, are you mostly talking about how you deal with town councils or city councils when you're a resident?
Well, I've been in both. I've been in a resident in the town, and I've been in other towns where I'm not a resident. And we would have myself and other people who were residents there. But to indicate your question, one, what I always try to do is to, and over time, I know there are a number of questions that come up that people have that indicate really some little understanding of the strings attached to the HUD grants. And I try to take these and and put these out there. For instance, one of the things you hear and I heard often was, well, we've taken these grants for years. We never had a problem, right? And I will say to a person, I'll say, you might be thinking that, you know, you've taken these grants for years and you never had a problem. And it's true, you never had. And I'll tell them why, right? And I'll say, here's how things have changed. If I hear something that somebody says, like they're dissenting from you or they have an objection to what you're going to say, then what I try to do is, number one, I have to be prepared to answer whatever it is. But I'll also go into, you know, the old feel, felt, found. I'll say, you know, I know what your concern is. I felt that way too. But then I did some research. Here's what I found on it. And again, I'll go back to quote from HUD on what it is. So some of the questions I've, you know, heard over time was, well, you know, we already have affordable housing in our town. Why would HUD bother us? And so then I say, yeah, you know, why would they bother you? I said, but here's what they say about affordable housing and affirmatively further fair housing. And I quote from that. So I tried to.
Yeah. So Al, it sounds like most of what you're relating is content on questions they had and answers you have. What I experienced was they were prepared for me and they weren't very inquisitive. It was, you know, it was almost rather confrontational. And so what I really feel I need to do is prepare for cases that become confrontational. And that's a low winning percentage.
Well, I've heard that from people too. I've heard people say, well, you know, this is low risk. This is not a big deal. And then I would simply have to say, you know what? I would have to, no matter how confrontational they were, I mean, if they're outright severely hostile, I still have to say to them, look, I understand what you're saying is blah, blah, blah. Trying to build some kind of empathy and some kind of bridge before I say what I usually say is, look, I understand that. I've checked it out. I know how you feel. I had the same concerns you did. Here's what I found. Now, if their minds are absolutely closed, I will still say that, and I'll say it, but I'd like to continue to be in touch and give you information.
You know, Al, what I thought of real quick, and let me get this out, is with the election coming up, we're going to have a lot of new people, new town councils, new representatives, and we should be updating our email list for those, like I cover all the communities in Colorado that get grants. So I'm going to be doing a big update after the election. So I think that's the good news, is we're going to have some new people to talk to.
Yeah.
Let me go down to this to address actually Smith what you were saying. And Smith, by the way, you come up with some really great ways to respond to that low risk argument. And maybe you'll share some of those in a few minutes. But we do have to address that these objections. Now, for the audience who's listening, who's in the toolkit. On the Sustainable Freedom Lab website, if you're in the toolkit, all you have to do is scroll down the page. You'll see under presentation, you'll see a heading that says counter objections. And the very first link there kind of responds to what Smith is talking about and what Al is talking about right now. It's called A Letter to Public Officials Explaining AFFH Misconceptions. And what this is, this is an actual letter that was used in a very hostile environment. And we've left all the names off of here, so I think we're okay. But the county executive in this case just kind of denied everything that was happening. He was making up stories. He, in many cases, he didn't even know the answers to stuff. He just kind of threw it out there because he wanted the money. He didn't want to hear anything except, you know, they want the money. So we responded to an awful lot of what he had to say in this letter. So I recommend that letter as something that you can either click on and download and use it, or just get some information from that. You might want to share it in full or copy and paste, you know, bits and pieces here and there. But overcoming objections is a huge thing. Now, the largest objection that I've run into that I want to share with you right now. since we're covering this anyway, we kind of segued into that, is this idea, well, I'm going to talk to my HUD representative. They'll know what to do. And, of course, they talk to HUD, and HUD comes back and says, it's no big deal. There's nothing to worry about here, and, you know, that it doesn't apply to you anyway. Or whatever they may or may not say. However, what most officials don't realize is that the words that HUD say are nothing but representations. They're not binding in any way whatever. And there's a court case that decided that. It was Big Meadows Grazing. And I've included that under counter-objections. You'll see that court case right down there. And basically, a federal agency has made a whole bunch of promises to somebody, to this Big Meadows Grazing. They entered into a conservation easement together. And then all of a sudden, all those promises that the government made, they reneged on them. Big Meadows took it to court, and court said, well, those promises don't mean anything. They said they're not included in legal documents. They're not part of the contract. The government didn't approve it, so basically it doesn't mean anything. So that's going to be a huge response when somebody says, well, HUD says it was okay. Here's your proof in writing that no, what they said is not necessarily okay. But, Smith, you and I were talking the other day about how you are responding to that idea that, we don't think this is a particularly high-risk problem for our community. Do you want to share what you said?
Well, the one that pops into my mind is I've essentially written an ad I'm going to put in the newspaper for Colorado Springs, and I'm going to be – so they said it was low risk, and they said, well, we can always change our mind in the future, to which, John, I know you've got another answer. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to put an ad in the paper, and I'm going to be soliciting something to the effect that – has anybody been discriminated again, or have anybody had problems with affordable housing? It's going to be very general. Essentially, I'm going to be soliciting for people who could possibly take, who would be, and I'm going to say, are you interested in a lawsuit against the county on behalf of HUD? And then I'm going to, with that ad and that, I'm going to go to the county commissioners, and I'm going to say, do you still think it's low risk and there's no risk here? And any lawsuit you enter into is going to be a lot more expensive than the money you're currently receiving.
Yeah, I think people have to be aware when they say it's low risk. Well, what's low risk? I'm sure when Westchester County took the money, they took their HUD money over the years, they didn't think there was much risk involved in it because they've been taking it for probably decades. So, you know, what was the risk? Well, any risk is a higher risk than most communities want to take. I'm going to move on and go down to the next section here. So you want to be able to state your case in clear terms, get people on your side ahead of time before you get in there, use that video, Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing, open it up by telling the group that you're speaking to, the Planning Commission or whatever the group may be, I'm really not here to talk to people as a Democrat or a Republican. I'm here to help you retain your authority because it's at risk. And let me explain why that is, and then kind of slide into whatever your presentation may be. Now, the next section down here, I say you want to win attorneys to your side. And that's so important. For those of you who've already downloaded my ebook, Agency Tyranny, there's an entire section in there on what to say to attorneys, how to open up the conversation. So I urge you to just... And on our website, you can click on that. Again, this is all free. Agency Tyranny, go near, I think it's chapter 10 or something like that. In there, it explains exactly what to say to attorneys. But briefly, let me explain why winning attorneys to your side is so critical. You can build your case to a couple of friendly public officials or planning commissioners. And they may feel, wow, you know, you're right, this is too much of a risk. We don't want to take a chance on having the federal government be able to control our local zoning or being able to force us into a region. But when they tell their fellow commissioners who may be more interested in working with the Chamber of Commerce or getting money from a local corporation or a friend that's got a new development going up, all of a sudden that argument begins to fall apart and they find ways around it. But when the attorney walks in and says, if you take this money, you could be facing a $30 million lawsuit. People wake up. They listen to that. So it's imperative that we begin to explain to attorneys what it is that's going on. That's why part of our database through Property Value Defense is dedicated to improving relationships with attorneys and letting them know what's going on with this. So in that section on your internet under ending Hutt's tyranny, under presentation where it says attorney's packet, you will find on the screen there a whole series of documents. And I won't go through every document because it's all defined. In each case, for instance, the first document says AFFH in the Federal Register. And above it are a couple of sentences that explain what that's all about. So each step of the way, it explains what these documents are. Now, the reason that I've selected those is because they're ones that I've found through experience appeal to attorneys. In many cases, this is one law firm talking to another law firm. This isn't somebody's opinion. It's not an article in the National Review, or not that there aren't excellent articles there, and some of the best, by the way. But this is something that's legalese, that they can really sink their teeth into and realize, hey, this is serious. So that little packet has, I don't know, at least, oh gosh, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 different documents there. I strongly urge you to open those up and familiarize yourself with those. Now, two of those documents, again, Smith, I know I keep picking on you, but two of those documents, the Douglas County Statement of Concerns to HUD over affirmatively furthering fair housing and Castle Rock, these are so important, I think, for our audience to understand what they are. Could you just very briefly take just a minute or two with each one? Could you explain what those are and why they're so important?
Well, the letter that you're referring to from Castle Rock, which happens to be a town within Douglas County, was the first vote taken against accepting the grant. And the letter you're referring to goes into detail on why they didn't think it was a good idea. For a town to be a recipient of a grant or a city, they have to have a population of 50,000. For a county to accept the grants, they have to be a county of at least 200,000. So we've actually got four towns and cities in Douglas County, but because it's a block grant, Douglas County takes a grant and they give it to other towns and cities. And in this case, they didn't give any to Castle Rock. But the county's primary objection, I think, John, you spoke with Sheriff Weaver, I believe, right?
Yeah.
You and I haven't discussed that.
Yeah.
He brought up a new issue with regard. He was previously the sheriff. And not only did he see the threat of the legal liabilities, but he also brought up a new threat with regard to the county not having jurisdiction over the police or the sheriff. And there were things that he was being asked to sign that essentially had to do with affirmatively furthering fair housing and the use of force. And that was yet another objection. And I think the letters that you're referring to that are, you know, documented here are well worth reading in detail, because they go into over the zoning, they go into property rights, and they go into the county's responsibility. But in any way, I hope that I'm answering some of your questions.
You are. Yeah, no, that's a fine job. All those documents you do want to look at, but the one from Castle Rock and the other from Douglas County, particularly effective, because this is a done deal. Douglas County, by the way, now has also dropped out of this. They've also refused to take those HUD monies. So, yeah, that's all part of what I call the attorney's packet. So that's another arrow in your quiver, is to begin to win the attorneys over to your side. And you also have to be able to raise public awareness, and that's if you look on page 3 in the guide that you downloaded, the strategic guide, on number 3 it says raising public awareness, talking to neighbors, handing out flyers, and so on. Well, Mike Hoskinson, Mike has just done an incredible job of raising awareness about what's going on in Huntington Beach. And before the program started, I overheard him also talking about what you're doing to bring the vote in, to get the people aware of what's going on out there and who they should be voting for. And can you share a little bit of that with us, Mike? I know the audience would love to hear what you guys are doing out there.
Absolutely. Thanks, John. So I was at a a little bit here to tell you how far along we are. As I'm listening to all you guys talking, I'm watching Facebook, and I'm watching a number of groups that we've helped create in creating chat groups of citizens who are so involved while we're talking. These people are working in the background trying to implement the changes we all want to see in our town. And the success that we've had here came from us finding what we would call a solid gold or a bulletproof issue that everyone virtually agrees on in the town. For us, it was high-density housing, which, as we know, is tied intimately to AFFH and what they're trying to force on the towns. So we found that that issue across every political, age, ideological barrier, everybody simply said no to it because they've implemented a number of it in our town. So we took that issue and we took it to Facebook, where there had already been a couple Facebook forums created specifically for people in Huntington Beach. And through a process of continually bringing information to the public about the issues and about people that both supported and did not support high-density housing, we've built a really strong coalition of people. And now we're in the final couple days of helping two candidates hopefully get elected. And we've just done some telephone polling, and we find that one of our candidates, who is a gal that works with me on the Planning Commission, is polling at the top of all of the about 12 candidates that are running right now. So we're really hopeful she'll get on. The second one entered a bit late. He had very little name recognition, but he's, because of all the work we've done, pulled at the top of that. So we've got three open slots, and what we're doing is trying to keep the folks off that we know are going to be ones that promote high-density housing. So we have gone into, I mean, and this would be a subject for a later call that we could dedicate to this, because there's so much information to teach the public about what to do during election time. We just don't have time for it here. But suffice to say that we've taken it street level, where we have people on our team that understand precincts and voting and polling to the level that we have been effective in building teams that literally have gone door to door in 97% of our precincts in town we've covered. So, and we're hoping to get 100% by Tuesday. So, we really have gone old school. It's a combination of old school street level politics and high tech via Facebook and using Facebook ads and just, but having like the beginning of the document here, build a team. And that's something that we'll probably want to talk about a little bit later, as well as of having a very small, we had three people as our small core team, and build from there in outer rings of different people that you use for different things. But it's very doable. It just takes planning. And again, finding that bulletproof issue that everybody agrees on. And from that, it's a bit of a, not an effortless ride, but it makes it a lot easier if you don't have to fight ideology with people.
Yeah, that's great, Mike. I mean, and this is, we all need to hear this. I need to hear this. We all do. It's so important to understand that even though this government has literally become a behemoth behind people's backs, our neighbors, unfortunately, who aren't aware of what's going on, they have no idea how gigantic and overpowerful the government is becoming. But you can beat it back. And it's done in the local communities. When the Constitution said all those other powers are for that aren't strictly forbidden to the states, they belong to the people. That's us, and that's our local communities. That's one of the reasons why HUD has this concentrated attack on communities to move us into regions. Because once you're moved into a region, the jurisdictional boundary for your local community melts away, and suddenly those local planning commissions have no authority any longer. It's the stripping away of authority. When that local authority goes away, then, of course, your local planning rights, zoning rights go away, your ability to decide what you want to do with a swimming pool in your backyard, all that begins to gradually disappear. So, Mike,
if I can jump in real quick and mention Stanley Kurtz's book about regionalism is probably the best thing somebody could read on that to understand why it is they would want to fold everything into a county too. And ends up being all about money and power is all it is.
Spreading the wealth. Yeah, Stanley Kurtz is Spreading the Wealth. So it's a wonderful book. I'm sure it's on Amazon. You can download that. It's a fantastic book to get. By the way, I've spoken to Mike, and we are going to be getting together in the very near future to get into more details, more of a roadmap, if you will, on how can we create forums like this for ourselves? How can we move a community of 20 or 30 or 40,000 people or even 10,000 people to move in the direction and bring out the left and right together? And we're going to give you instructions exactly how you can do that also. So that's all we have planned for the very near future here. So you want to make social media work for you. I'm looking back on page 3 of the presentation, the strategic guide that you had downloaded. All this is what Mike has just covered. You want to find the money. We hit on this in our first presentation a little bit. I think Mike Smith had gone into that. If you're going to go to a community and talk about giving up the $1 million grant money or the $100,000 or the $3 million, instead of just being a naysayer, you want to also be a creative person who works with the Planning Commission and with the public official to find another source for the money. Is there another thing that we can do here? And there are other ways out there, and that's what Smith had talked about. We can look at fundraisers, corporate sponsors, matching donations. In Tennessee, we have this East Tennessee Foundation that does get money from HUD. They also, there's a lot of money they don't get from HUD. So maybe we can work with them and find ways to get the money in other places. But you want to look for other ways to find the money. We talked a little bit about countering objections, which is number 6 on page 3. And again, if you scroll down to on your computer there to countering objections, you'll see two different ways to respond there. But you'll also see right next to countering objections, or underneath that, we're taking the fight to HUD, and that's so important because we don't want to have a defensive game going here. You want to go in there stating good information, but you also want to say, well, wait a minute. Part of the reason we don't want to take this money, it's not just a matter of HUD controlling us. It's a matter of they're doing things that actually hurt the community. They actually hurt low-income families. And under 7, we give you a couple of examples of that. The first one is HUD relocates low-income houses, families against their will by lowering their current voucher payments and raising the voucher payments in areas where they want them to move. So all of a sudden HUD is saying, we want these low-income families to have upward mobility, and we're going to get that by moving them into fancier areas. So when the family says, well, wait a minute, I don't want to move to a fancier area. I don't know anybody over there. I can't afford all the nice things these people can afford. I want to stay right where I am. So HUD says, well, you know what? You live in a zip code where the rents are lower. So we're paying you too much. We're going to lower the amount Section 8 voucher money you're getting here, but we're going to raise it if you go over there. Now you tell me, do you want to take a cut or do you want to move where we tell you to move? So this is kind of blackmail. You're forcing people into doing what it is that you're being told to do. So we try to get as much of that out on the table as we can. Now this is kind of guys, I haven't asked you, we had three incredible people here, but I really never asked you about this question. Have you ever looked, either of you, at the downsides of taking this grant money and how it actually does more harm than good? I don't know if anybody has any thoughts on that.
Well, I do have a little bit of insight. We talked about it last time a bit as well, that initially when I started researching grants in our town, I found that grants that were taken up to, in 2015 when I started doing research, that totaled up to roughly 1% of the entire budget of the city of Huntington Beach. So when I went to the city council to warn them about taking this money, and I said, well, effectively, if we can't find 1% or deny 1% in the budget, we're saying we're effectively bankrupt. So I don't think anybody's got the courage to say it, and certainly they did not, to put them on notice. But really, it's helpful to understand how much of this represents your entire city budget for any given year to see, go, look, if you can't refuse one point, you're in deep trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of the research that you want to be doing in the very beginning is find out how much money are we taking and what as a percentage of the budget, what is that? Is there any other way that we can possibly replace that? So when Smith asked the question, well, what's the risk? Well, what's the risk worth if you got a $300 million budget and you're talking about a $500,000 check? So we need to look at all of those aspects. part of the way that we take
on.
Yes, Smith.
So, John, I'm thinking about your question about other downsides and just being creative here for a moment. You know, what I'm thinking of is, you know, Section 8, the vouchers, now the new ones you're referring to are called the super vouchers, and the first I heard of it was when they said this is going to be one of Obama's last things he's going to do before leaving. But the super vouchers are very much related to what's called the low-income tax credit, which is an IRS tax credit. And the downside, the best way for me to explain is what happened here where I live in Douglas County, is we're still going through quite a bit of development. And, you know, Douglas County is ranked as the 8th wealthiest county in the country. So we're still doing a lot of developing here. And what we discovered in this major development, because somebody just asked the question, is that because of low-income housing, nobody knew in the neighborhood. These are homes probably around $500,000. You know, we're not California, but the average price of a home may be $400,000 or $500,000. And people who have been buying homes are suddenly seeing these large apartment, high-density housing going up. And they didn't know that it was because of the low-income housing tax credit, which I did some research on to find out. But the downside is on the property that is, I guess what I'm pointing to is the low-income housing tax credit, which isn't directly AFFH, but indirectly what happens to this is probably, I think, 40% of the units are actually going to be occupied by what was called Section 8 and now is called the vouchers. The downside is for the people who have been buying homes, and this is over the last couple of years, the salespeople basically tell them, oh, there's going to be some multifamily units go up. But there's no mention of this low-income housing tax credit. So the downside is the effect on property, is the deceit when people buy homes and they're not being told about the planned construction of this low-income housing tax credit and the Section 8 and the vouchers. So I thought I'd just put that out there.
No, that's a very good point, yeah. And this
John?
Is all tied in. Yeah, Al.
Yeah, I just want to say when you're talking about the high-density housing, and when we looked at that, because in Jersey you have the whole coalition on affordable housing, in which the state mandates a certain number of affordable housing in your community. They haven't decided how much for each community yet. That's still waiting. But when we looked at that, there are a couple of things. Number one, there's an impact on your school. There's more kids come into the school system. In some of the towns, they had to do an $11 million expansion, not in our town, but in some other towns. You talk about traffic, increase in traffic, and that high-density housing, and mostly even if it's not low-income housing, those are not positive ratables for a town. When you factor in your support services, when you factor in fire and support and trash and all that kind of stuff, those turn out to be negative ratables. And in a number of towns, we did some research. Once you get over 100,000 or so, you wind up having to have a paid fire department. Whereas up to that point, you can have volunteer fire departments. So there's a lot of impact to that.
That's rather interesting because as you start to get into those paid fire departments, and HUD comes in and begins to move you into regions. What happens is the chiefs that have to run each of these different fire departments, their salaries begin to go up. Because if you're in a community, let's say a small town like Crossville outside of Chattanooga, Tennessee, or maybe a Cleveland outside of Chattanooga, Tennessee, suppose you were to form a region out of that. We find out Eleanor Ostrom, who was who won the Nobel Prize in economics, I forget what year it was. She did studies, traveled all over the country, studying what happens to salaries when you form these unions and these regions, and you add on this personnel, like you're just talking about, Al. What happens is because the person in the in the high density in the urban area, like let's say Chattanooga, because the salary of the fire chief there is already high. When they absorb these other surrounding communities, he now has the responsibility of taking on these other communities. So he says, well, wait a minute, I need to be making more money. So he gets a raise. Meanwhile, the fire chiefs in all those surrounding communities, they say, well, wait a minute, there's such a big disparity between what he's making and what we're making. We need more money. So what happens is everybody's salaries go up, and the costs begin to ultimately go through the roof. So, again, there's been studies done on that, and I urge you to look up Eleanor Ostrom and study some of her work on this.
Can I make it interject? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, sure, Mike, go ahead, and I'll wrap up, yeah.
So what we found in Huntington Beach, and it's kind of fascinating right now, our grassroots have been so effective that we have forced the business interests that have been trying to force high-density housing, which is the Chamber of Commerce and the Building Industry Association and other related type of groups. They have been losing traction for so long that they've been forced at the end of the campaign to join forces with the police and fire unions. And now they're taking all that money and sending out big mailers and duping the public into believing these are the right guys to put on the city council. So the thing you find as well is that when a population grows, the unions make the case that they have to increase hiring. So all these constituencies of these special interests feed each other. So when you're hearing things from your builders groups and your chamber of commerces and your unions, they are self-serving, and they're lying to your face about that it's good for the town because it's not.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Let me just bring a couple of tie a couple of pieces together here. Al talked about asking questions in the very beginning. We have taken these grants for years and never had a problem. How do you respond to that? We already have affordable housing in our town. Why would HUD want to bother us? These are good questions that they may ask you, but it shows that the public official you're talking to really has no idea what's going on. You want to have the answers to these questions. On this page on the internet there, Ending HUD's Tyranny, it's answered in all of those documents, plus that little letter that I told you under countering objections. They're answered in there also. Those questions, along with some others that you want to be asking the public officials, are already on that page. You'll have to scroll to the very, very bottom of it. There's a section called Additional Information, and under there, the first link is AFFH Final Questions, and it says AF after that. That's our friend Dr. Al Precht. So those questions are posted on there. Now, before I talk about this new initiative, and I think we really need to understand that, let me just wrap up this piece on taking the fight to HUD. There is very little, if anything, in the affirmatively furthering fair housing HUD rule that's going to help low-income families. It interferes in their lives. It moves them. It talks about upward mobility. It talks about income integration. It talks about better educational outcomes. So all of these is it's all jargon. In the end, the only thing this program actually does is it recreates control over the social mechanism in your community. It doesn't do any that it does extraordinarily well. It takes the authority away from you and it transfers it. It leaves the people hanging. And if you look at the years since fair housing has gone into effect, You can see lots of vouchers that have been given out, and there's lots of families that have been given benefits and so on and so forth. But there's been no real substantive change in the educational level, in the crime reduction level, in the bettering of the life of the people who are receiving these benefits. So there's no reason to believe that it's going to continue going forward. But we can change these people's lives. And lives change when there's opportunity. There has to be opportunity for jobs, for a place for people to go. That's what gives you upward mobility. But Smith was asking me before the program, well, I'm not hearing an awful lot from HUD these days. What's going on? Are they quieting down until after the election? I don't hear any new lawsuits. You know, what's going on with these guys? Well, two very big things are going on with them. Number one, you're right. They're not really pursuing a whole bunch of legal action right now. They're just kind of staying under the radar. Wait until the election's over. If Hillary Clinton gets in, as I said in the last program, she's very much a friend of Julian Castro, the head of HUD. You're going to see this thing jump up to steroids, but not probably until after the election or perhaps after the beginning of the new year. But there's another program that they're involved in. I mentioned Upload Mobility a few times. They have a program that's based on MTO, Moving to Opportunity. Moving to Opportunity is an old program that HUD had tried in the 1994. And by 2011, they'd gone back and assessed the value of it, and they found that what they did in it, to explain, it's just as the name implies, they took people from low-income families, they gave them heftier vouchers and moved them to nicer areas, low-income families into nicer areas. And the assumption was that the school grades would go up, the crime would go down, the families would be better off. So what happened was, after 15 years, food stamp usage went up, crime went up, and they didn't do any better in school, except under age 13, they did a little bit better. Other than that, it basically was very little change. The program was an utter failure. However, in the earlier part of this year, actually the end of last year, HUD decided we're going to ramp up this program, and they have. They've ramped it up with a fury. So you are going to see this whole notion of moving to opportunity, moving to areas of opportunity. You're going to find this working its way through all of the HUD literature. So start looking for those terms, MTO. They accomplish it by misrepresentation. They have a report that was done by Raj Shetty. He's done about two or three reports on that experiment in the 90s. And finally, by micro-studying it, they came up with one or two points that actually worked. And they emphasize those and ignore everything else. But the bottom line is, the report has a line in there that says you can't really rely on this to make any changes because we're not too certain of the outcomes. And yet that's what everything's based on. The information on that is included under updates near the bottom end of this web page. So there's a lot going on with HUD right now, and it's all geared toward being able to control your communities. Now, I want to share something with you that I wrote an article about this the other day, about a week ago. It's this thing called ICANN, and it ties into everything that we're talking about. It's huge. When you hear it, it's going to sound so big that your first reaction is going to be, oh, my God, you know, what can we possibly do about it? And there's a lot we can do about it, but mainly it's like doing the things like our three guests have talked about, attacking this thing professionally, learning the information, understand what's going on, and like Mike and Smith and Al are doing, work with small groups in one community at a time, and we can beat this thing back. ICANN is the Internet Corporation for the Assignment of Names and Numbers. A lot of people never heard of it. It was a small group in California out there that basically sets up all the Internet protocol names, the IP addresses, and the names for every domain in the world, not just here, but throughout the world. Well, that company had a host, and the host was the United States of America, because essentially the Internet started under the military, so we kept it there. And we kept it there through a contract. We had a contract called the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, IANA. President Obama, that contract has been renewed every year, year after year after year that's been renewed. The United States was in charge of it. President Obama, on September 30th, allowed that contract to lapse. We are no longer the host company. That made ICANN a free agent to seek a new host anywhere in the world they want to. And they are. And they have takers right now, and it appears it's either going to be Russia, China, or the United Nations. Now, who cares about ICANN? ICANN can do a couple of things. They not only issue all of the IP addresses for Internet domains, including .gov and not .mil for the military. They also control the IP addresses, get ready for it, for all of your devices and what they call the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things might be your smart TV. It might be your self-diagnosing, self-repairing LG refrigerator that has a sensor that can be wirelessly communicated with. It might be your cell phone. It might be a GSP device that you have. It might be your air conditioner that's equipped with a sensor. When it receives that sensor, it also receives an IP address. That's addressable. That address is established by ICANN, and it's addressable by a local smart meter or perhaps some other device. So what happens is, since those individual appliances are addressable, since they have an individual IP address, then whoever controls ICANN has the ability to control every one of those devices worldwide on an individual basis. At any given time, they could turn your air conditioner on and off, your lights on or off, anything in your home that's supplied with a sensor. So that's step number one. Now, we know that the United Nations seems to take the lead, and they may well be the ones that now become the host company for ICANN. ICANN themselves are what they call technocrats. They don't care about any of this. They don't care what's done with the material. All they care is about getting paid and seeing that the science moves forward. But there's another step in here, and this is the piece we need to understand. In September of 2015, President Obama signed an order to advance $160 million to develop his Smart Cities Initiative. Now, remember I talked about the Internet of Things. That's all the things that can be communicated with through the Internet via a sensor. Pretty much anything in your home, speaker system, sound system, so forth. In this $160 million initiative to develop these smart cities, he has agreed to begin creating test beds for the Internet of Things applications and developing new multi-sector collaborative models for technological advancements and diminishing the cost of IT infrastructure. The bottom line here is he's going to give $160 million to these smart cities. Who are they? They're starting out with New York City, Tampa, Florida, Wyoming, and they're linking through municipal vehicles and traffic signals right now to begin to control that centrally. But from there, it can begin to spread virtually into anywhere. Now, just before he relinquished the contract with ICANN on September 30th of 2016, this year, in September of 2016, another thing he did was give another $80 million to this Smart Cities project. And in here, again, he says, collectively, these awards, that means the money that's been given out to the communities, are to help establish the technological foundation for smart cities and the Internet of Things. I can't make it any clearer than that. The Obama administration and the Hillary administration, if she should become president, is forging ahead with these smart cities, which will ultimately be able to, through these sensors and the ICANN protocol technology, be able to literally be the wheelhouse that controls every single device in your home. So this is a reality right now, and the money's being funded to make this happen. I make you aware of that. I am working with a dear friend of mine who said he's got some contacts with scientists. We're going to see if there are some ways around this thing, technical ways. I'm sure there will be, ultimately. But right now, we need to say no to grant money. We need to say no to smart cities. We need to say no to HUD coming into our region and setting up affirmatively furthering fair housing. All these different programs, we have to become financially independent and go back to living within our financial means again, not getting dragged into the federal government. So I apologize for going on and on and on with this, but I wanted to let everybody understand what this is. We're going to be addressing this in the future and also coming up with ways that we can respond on a national basis and begin to defeat this. And by the way, we are looking at going much larger nationally, getting a larger organization here. We're looking for funding to begin to make that happen because it takes a lot of money to do the things we're talking about, but we want to be there for you so we can get this out there and make a difference. Gentlemen, this might be the first time you're hearing this, or maybe you're already familiar with it. What I'd like to do is in about 2 or 3 minutes here, we're going to ask our audience to hit *6, and then they can ask any questions that you may have. But meanwhile, do you gentlemen have any other... Mike or Smith or
hi, John. Hi, John.
Ghostman.
Yeah, John. Coincidentally, I'm looking. I'm a little bit behind in articles I'm publishing on the AFFH.net website because I've been so involved with the current campaigns going on. But I'm looking at an article I'm getting ready to publish, and it's by someone who's the former commissioner on the Federal Communications Commission. It's in the Wall Street Journal, and the date is October 26, and the title is The Authoritarian Internet Power Grab. And it's really about a conference that's beginning in Tunisia. And it's repeating pretty much everything you just said. And it kind of summarizes saying that America must quickly move beyond the divisive argument about ICANN and regain Internet policy footing. And anyway, I'm going to put this article up, but everything you said is just now happening, and it's totally current. So anyway, just wanted to kind of
follow up with
what you've been saying.
Smith's website, by the way, is mentioned on our website. If you go to Ending HUD's Journey, one of the recommendations we make is to use that as an asset, so as a resource. So you'll be able to go there. We'll also have a lot of this stuff. Everything I've talked about tonight is under updates on HUD initiatives and additional information. You'll find it all down there. So any other comments from our guests?
Sure. You know, we're going to talk about it more at length, but, you know, we just can't tell you strongly enough to learn how to organize your community. We've been so successful with it in Huntington Beach. I think we've really, you know, we like Rahm Emanuel said, we never let a crisis go to waste in town. Now, you know, we've really learned how to take. My word for it is jujitsu. We take everything, no matter whether it's an attack on us. We use the energy. We turn it around on the other side. So you know, kind of quickly can learn how to become very effective and very bulletproof if you learn the techniques of, you know, reading Saul Alinsky or some of the other guys that were intended for the other side, but all applicable for things we want to achieve. And I will tell you that the folks that they don't know how to defend this when it goes back on them too. So it's quite fun to use it against the people who originated it.
Nothing like having fun while you're winning the game. I like it a lot. Thank you, Mike. Okay, so CJ, again, anybody out there who has a question or would like to ask our panel a question, just hit *6. Do we have any people with a question right now?
Yes, sir. This is James Hammondtree from Alcoa, Tennessee.
Hi, James.
We have two. Hello, how are you? Glad to
Good.
Be part of this program. We have
Thank
two
you.
Tennessee senators, Corker and Alexander, who I think are fair fiddling while Tennessee burns like Nero did with Rome. And a representative whose family, he and his father, have held that seat for 53 years. And we can't get him out, but he doesn't do anything worthwhile except get people's Social Security payments straightened out. And that's what gets him elected every year.
Yep.
Well, I'm really concerned about the lack of a taxation without representation. I think we're right back to where we were before the revolution. And if a certain person gets elected, there's going to be another revolution. And our wonderful governor...
do you have a question for our panel? You're right. I agree with you
overall.
Do you have a question for our panel?
Yes, sir. It looks like they're letting all these federal agencies, HUD especially, get away with violating the Constitution and the rule of law. And I'm going to call my representative and the senator tomorrow and ask them why they aren't doing something about it.
Okay. I think that's a good point of action.
Yes, sir.
Let me offer this.
Yes, sir.
Thank you,
Go
James.
Ahead.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for allowing me to say what I had to say. You're saying something. What did you say, sir?
I said it's appreciated. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you folks, too. Bye.
Now, the one thing that James mentioned, you know, what do? We got Corker here. We got, and I live in Tennessee now, so I know exactly what James is talking about. He's right on the money. Well, I tell you what you do. We get rid of them. We have to get rid of them. We have to stop putting the biggest liar in town in office because they smile and they know how to lie really well. I saw a commercial, and I said we weren't going to get too political with this thing, but I watched a commercial that blew my mind the other night. It was Hillary Clinton with a wonderful, glowing, grandmothery kind of smile on her face and all the sincerity in the world, saying how 90% of her Clinton Foundation money, you know, goes to help these different charities. I mean, you couldn't look at that woman but say, wow, what a wonderful thing she's doing. And then right next to it's a picture of IRS form showing it's not 90%, it's 5.7%. So, I mean, she's lying through her teeth. And we have to begin to see through this and convince our neighbors to see through it, too. We've got to bring the general public into the point where we realize the media is part of the problem. There is no media in the United States. There is no news. It's all just part of the game. And we have to become the media ourselves to share that information. two things that we can do to get rid of these people. One is exactly what Mike Hoskins doing. Hoskinson is doing, and I can't describe it any better than he can because he's doing it. So we're going to be amplifying that in an upcoming program to go step by step with it. Another thing that I urge everyone to do is my good friend Mark Herr has the Center for Self Governance. If you go to my website sustainablefreedomlab.org and you look over on the right hand column, if you're on the on a PC, if you're on a mobile device, I think you have to keep scrolling down the screen till you get to it. You'll see a link to his website. I urge you to take his course. I forget how much it costs. It's worth it. It's not an awful lot of money, and it's well worth it. He shows you how to begin to work legislatively in your community. So those are the two things that I would recommend. Do we have another listener with a question?
Yes. Hi, this is Shelley Kennedy. I want to thank everyone for the presentation tonight. It's been very interesting and helpful. Even though I've been in the fight for a while, it's always good to hear what other people are doing and get new ideas. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Shelley.
I wanted to find out, I have just come into knowledge of a particular town. Some people came to me with a situation where they have a very, very much a crony situation in their town. It's a small Jersey town, and Al will be very familiar with this. Small Jersey town, lots of cronyism, and the people in power love smart growth, and they love all that federal funding. And they've signed contracts, and they've accepted money. The question is that people have come to me and said, how do we get out of this? How do we unwind this thing? It's one thing to go in and say, let's not sign the money and don't sign the papers. What if it's already happened? What if they're already building the mixed-use apartments buildings with retail on the bottom, and they're already overbuilding for the school system and the well infrastructure? How do we start? What is it? Do you have a plan for something like that?
Actually, I have some ideas on it, but before I share mine, let's go to the panel. They've probably got even better stuff.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm going to look up an article I want everybody to go to. There is a website called cumbelich.com, cumbelich.com. Look for the article called The Inconvenient Truth About Mixed Use. John Cumbelich is a retail development specialist. He wrote this on January 25th of this year. It completely destroys the myth of mixed use. So read that and use that in your argumentation against it. It's a failed type of development, but it exists because there is subsidy money for it. And then your local chamber of commerce and your local builders are all making money off it. So that's, and they're always tied with your councils. Therefore, this is why people are forcing it. And again, it ties in with the unions as well, because the more people in your town, the more employees they're going to require. So there's a lot of places this crosses over. But this article, above all, I call this the smoking gun against mixed use.
There you go. Spell the name again.
Why don't we do this? Let me email this to you, so we'll post it perhaps.
Got it. I'll get it posted right on here. It'll be here by this evening. First of all, another way to look at this, Shelley, is these things don't make any money. If you go to community after community, I remember a small community I was in central New Jersey, and they had this beautiful mixed-use building. They had a big techno rock thing going there and had a couple of real estate offices, and that was it. It was a pizza place, but they couldn't sell the places above it. And then the stores opened up, and then they started to close down. So very often they're also financial losers once they get done, and they make the town look even more barren. And I think Cumbelich might point some of that out in his article too. But good question. What do you do once you get into it? Very good question. Another one. You have about another 5 minutes.
That was the last question, John. We don't have another one yet.
Oh, okay. All right, gentlemen. Would you like to wrap up? Just maybe a short comment about what you think people can do most of all to fight against HUD moving into their community, especially if they're already in there. What can we do? I know we have Cumbelich's article there. Any other ideas you have, or just final thoughts for our audience?
I think, John, this is Al. One thing I think people need to do is to find out where their if their community has already taken the grant and signed on to a new grant under the new rule. That would be important to do. And then I think the other thing is, like, if this is mentioned a couple of times, you don't need 100 people to go fight this. You can have very small teams to go and address your town council one by one or as a panel. So, I mean, that's the one thing I found. You have a few dedicated individuals, they can go far with it.
Excellent. Smith, I know you've done a lot of detailed work. You're good at research and digging that out. How's that held you when you get in front of people and have to build an argument? Smith? I think we lost Smith.
Oops, sorry, I was on mute.
No.
Something that was pointed out to me by the county commissioners after he looked at what's going on is, you know, the consolidated plan for the new rule hasn't taken effect yet. And like here, and we're in what's called HUD's District 8, which is a multi-district, and only one county actually has to submit a consolidated plan this year. What he pointed out is it's going to be in the next, you know, the coming years, next 1, 2, 3 years, when counties actually have to start complying with the new AFFH rule, that he believes it's going to be easier for the elected officials to turn it down because it's going to be exposed for what it is. So I think what one of the arguments right now is to say, why do you have to say no today, which is what I addressed. It's the legal liabilities. But I believe it's going to become more and more apparent about how local government control is going to be taken away, and the regionalism is going to take over. So I guess my point is that we're just now beginning what should become exposed about HUD, that it's still not well known, but it's going to be, the information about what we're talking about is going to become more available.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And, Mike, do you have a last statement you'd like to make?
Yeah. So, you know, again, we're gonna get into this more later, but, you know, you've got to organize. You've got to get some training, whether it's Campaign for Liberty, which we went to, or Center for Self-Governance, both of them great. Form a very small team. Again, you don't need a big team. You need two, three folks that are very motivated that can, you know, be generals to go out and build an army of folks in your town that will spread the word and to find that one issue that crosses all the barriers and will stay away from the partisanship. So, you know, we'll go into that more in detail, but those would be the highlights for me.
Yeah, okay, good. Thank you. Let me leave you with a thought here. There's a book that I highly recommend. You get a lot of reading every time you log on here. I feel bad for the audience. There's in 2000, Hernando de Soto wrote a book called The Mystery of Capital, and I can't recommend it too much. It's not too long, a couple hundred pages long, but it's a quick read. And in here, he explains why this system of private property and ownership is so important in America. And I find that one of the biggest battles we have with public officials and some of our progressive friends in the community, they don't really understand what property means to them. But he explains, if you go in countries like Haiti, you may not realize it, but as poor as that country is, per capita and per average annual income, when you look on the basis of that, they save more money than we do as America. As Americans, many of the third world countries that we pump cash into, they have personal savings accounts that are worth more than the aid that we're sending there each year. So why can't they do anything? Because their capital is what he calls dead. If they own a home, they can't do anything with it. They may own a home, let's say, I'm going to make a number up, $200,000, but that's certainly not what a home costs in Haiti. But let's say $200,000, If you want to go down and borrow $50,000 against that house to start a business, you get to do that because your capital is liquid. You can do something with it. But if someone comes along and they control that property and your land use and it reduces the value, EPA says they govern a stream in your backyard and they demand a buffer for 600 feet or on either side. The value of your property plummets, there's less you can do with it, and your net worth just took a nosedive. That's less money for you to build a business, less money to live a good life, less money to pass on to your children. So property and the full ownership is important. That's why we have to keep ownership local, keep the government, the federal government, out of our local affairs, even if it means saying goodbye to them. We don't want to take your grant money. Folks, thank you so much for logging on. For dialing in. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. We're going to have another one of these coming up. It's probably going to be probably around December 4th is the next one. We got a holiday and of course we got Election Day coming up. Please don't forget to go out and vote. And I know I said no political, but let me say this. Donald Trump has said he would end affirmatively furthering fair housing. I hope he keeps his promise. I don't know about the other things going on. I'm not here to judge him more morally. I just need the job done right now and give serious consideration for that as you move forward. Thank you again for logging in and hope to speak to you in the future. Bye-bye.